Coming up next on Israel National Radio.
Singer here, Israel National Radio, David Solomon joining me live on air. It's the book of Isaiah, Yeshayahu, and we are in the midst of a journey. We are toward the end of the book of Isaiah, Isaiah 53. It's the fourth of four servant songs. And I repeat that because how frequent it is that people are familiar with one chapter, one text, one verse. Let me explain this to you. It's not just Isaiah 53. It's one of the most toxic things spiritually you can do is read a verse out of context. You can be certain that you'll be led down the wrong path. Isaiah 53 is our topic, David.
Definitely. Out of context is the key here, and as we've discussed the last two or three weeks, we started, I think, 2 weeks ago, we looked at the end of chapter 52, and then we began chapter 53. And we're only three or four verses. I don't know. Those of you who have been following our discussion on the book of Yeshayahu over the last few months will notice that Tovia and I are progressively slowing down. So in the beginning, we were like covering three or four chapters of program, and now we're literally spending each program on maybe two or three verses. That's how intense studying the book of Yeshayahu becomes, because it's like a big vortex, and you go deeper and deeper into it, but it also shows you a method of studying. You need to have an overview of the book, but you also need to have that overview not at the expense of studying the book in depth, every word, and not believing that the translation that you have necessarily is giving you the right meaning of the text. As you know, we'll come back to that another time, but I am a very big proponent of people reading this in Hebrew.
Yeah, reading in the original.
Absolutely, or at least studying with someone who can access the original, and that someone, Tovia, is you and me.
Yeah, and we're going to do that right here. And incidentally, just so you know, Kindlech, just so you know, children of the Most High, the suffering servant of Isaiah 53 is going to continue in Isaiah 54, still singular, about the Jewish people, but now the Jewish people in 54, we're not there yet. It's still going to be about the people of Israel who have been oppressed, despised, and rejected. And yet, of course, at the end of 54, we're going to talk about, Isaiah will describe the salvation
of
his wife.
Well, I can't wait to get to 54. 54 is, you know, Rani Akara Lo Yalada. It's massive. And the whole metaphor of Yeshayahu about the Jewish people changes from the suffering servant to the barren woman who can't have children. So it's a tremendous shift. And we haven't got there yet. We're still deep into 53. Now, two preparatory things we need to remind ourselves, Natavia, about 53, or remind the listeners. One is, as you said, chapter 53 doesn't start, the concept and the discussion doesn't start at verse 1 of chapter 53. It starts basically at the beginning of the book of Isaiah. No, but really, it really starts at this particular conversation at verse 13 of chapter 52. Can we move into chapter 53? As Tovia has said so many times, who's talking? Who's giving this speech that we're looking at? And we have repeatedly emphasized that the clear meaning from the text, both in terms of pshat and in terms of midrash, and in every layer in which you engage this text, unless you're really trying to obfuscate its meaning, the very clear meaning is that the nations of the world are expressing their tremendous surprise at the end of days when the true revelation of God is revealed in the world, and what exactly were the instruments that brought that about. All nations play a role in that unfolding drama, but the nation of Israel has a unique role in the revelation of God at the end of days. And that is what is surprising the nations of the world. What's amazing about this chapter is that this is the single most miscontextualized and misinterpreted chapter in the whole of the Tanakh, and yet the very subject matter of this chapter is the idea of misinterpretation.
So true. I want you all take a deep breath and listen very carefully to what you're about to hear. David and I didn't discuss this beforehand. I just wrap my frontal lobe around exactly what he's about to say. Go ahead.
Tovia will say this more adequately than I will in a moment, but I really wanted to make this point. As we read through the chapter, let's remember that we are currently looking, and we're holding only now about verse 3 and verse 4 of that chapter. We're currently looking at what it is that the nations are saying. We're not necessarily looking at what the real reality is. Mm. We're not talking about what God is actually wanting us to understand.
This is the reaction of the Gentiles.
This is the reaction of the Gentiles. So when we talk about things such as, you know, the suffering servant was despised and abhorred of men, and he had no, you know, had to hide his face and so on, and how amazing it is yet that the arm of the Lord is revealed upon this servant. This is the nation's impression. This is their astonishment. And, of course, ironically, it will be their astonishment when they realize who this chapter is actually talking about.
Right, exactly.
And that's a tremendous irony. It's so prophetic, it's so holy, it's so incredible that Isaiah 53 can turn you actually into a believing person in the God of Israel just from reading that chapter and looking at history and seeing exactly how this chapter has played a role in that history, precisely in line with what the chapter is talking about.
Let me just set this up because it's important that we break this down. We're discussing 15 verses from 52 verse 13 through 53 verse 12. Let me break it down so you understand what's happening here. 52 verse 13 through verse 15, God is speaking, setting up the response of the nations of the world, how the Gentile kings respond when they realize their staggering error. From 53 verse 1 until verse 9, that means through verse 8, but not including verse 9, the Gentile kings of nations are speaking. That means we are not getting systematic theology in 53 verse 1 through 8. We're getting the reaction of the Gentiles in the Messianic age to their astonishment, because everything they're finally seeing is like nothing they ever heard or considered. From verse 9 through verse 12, we revert back to the God of Israel speaking through the prophet of Isaiah. You got that set up?
Exactly, but still we're still in the early part of the chapter. So what we're looking at is what the nations are saying. What we're probably going to find out that the thesis that the nations are offering about what's going on, their speculative thesis to explain this, is in fact a misconception of what's actually going on.
Hmm.
So we just need to bear that in mind. It's almost like this is a play, and currently we're inside the soliloquy of the nations.
Beautiful, the soliloquy of the nations. You know that when I studied Hamlet, and when I had, it was pure agony. I didn't understand.
Really?
I thought the man was on crack, the whole Shakespeare.
Yeah, it was agonizing.
Until this day, and I'm 48 years old, I had to wait all these years to find where I can use the word soliloquy, where I can apply this word. I find one point, David and I are just going to be bouncing off each other constantly. One thing, bear in mind, there are many texts throughout the Jewish scriptures that describe the reaction of the Gentiles when the true Messiah comes. We have it here, we have it Isaiah 60, 61. We have it in many places in the Bible, and they are always shocked and surprised, and they realize at that moment they have gotten all wrong, Jeremiah 16, so on. There are many texts in the Jewish scriptures that describe the Jewish reaction in the Messianic age, and the Jews never respond, we got it wrong. The most astounding chapter, which really mirrors Isaiah 53, is when the Jewish people realize at the end of days what their suffering is all about. They pronounce their soliloquy in Isaiah chapter 12, verse 1, 2, 3, and 4, the beginning of that chapter. So Isaiah 12 and 53 are two chapters that parallel. Isaiah 12 is the soliloquy of the Jews. Isaiah 53 is the soliloquy of the Gentiles.
Yeah, and also bear in mind a couple of points we made last week. First of all, as Tovia said, we're going to bounce ideas off each other, and sometimes we might even go in directions that don't seem immediately relevant. And one point we made last week that's extremely important is that there really is no facet or subject of Jewish history and experience that is irrelevant to Isaiah 53. It contains so much, in summary, of what the Jewish people have been through. The other point in relation to that is what we discussed also last week, is that let's never ever forget our, what we might call our uber context, which is not only within the text and where we're up to and who's speaking and what the context is of this chapter, but in fact, who is the prophet Yeshayahu? When is he speaking? What prompted this vision? He is in fact prophesying over 100 years, 120 years, in fact, before the fall of Judah to the Babylonians. He has already seen the fall of the northern kingdom of Israel. We have just now become this definable entity called the Jewish people. And we have a role in history as the remnant of Israel. And Isaiah is seeing that and is projecting that throughout history and telling us what's going to happen at the end. So let's never lose sight of who Isaiah is, of the context of when he's pronouncing these words. And remember also, as we discussed last week, that there are many, many facets of Jewish history that are relevant to this. For example, just one small example, and obviously, Toby, you and I have no time to go into the whole of Jewish history, which only takes an hour, but we haven't got time to go into that. You know, we said an expression last week, for example, that this expression, Chadal Ishim, which you need to realize, I'll translate that in a moment, but Chadal Ishim is not simply a terminology used by the prophet Yeshayahu. It's a concept, the concept of Chadal Ishim. I alluded to this last week. We didn't really have time to go into it. It has many possible meanings. We looked at one very basic surface meaning, is that this person is basically, you know, so unrecognizably human that people shun away from it. It's not considered part of the human race. And that, of course, remember, this is what the nations are saying. Oh my gosh, we totally scorned and disregarded that person because we didn't even think they were human. And that has a whole corollary in Jewish history. But Chadal Ishim can also mean that they regarded the Jewish people as a nation that did not have great personalities. We have other examples where the word Ishim means heroes or great personalities. In other words, it was said many times of the Jewish people, especially by Aryan races, that the Jewish people do not have a sense of the noble or honor or virtue. In other words, they don't produce these great individuals. I'm thinking, for example, you know, like a guy like Moses Mendelssohn sitting in Berlin in the 18th century with his, you know, Toleranz patent. That is, he was very proud of the fact that he was a tolerated Jew. He wouldn't have been allowed to live in Berlin and teach philosophy, but he had a special patent from the king that said, even though you are a Jew, you may reside in Berlin and you may teach philosophy to other human beings. This idea that the Jewish people do not produce the heroic and do not produce great personalities, wrong, of course, on every count, because we have produced heroes and great people and great contributors to world society at every stage of history. But it's a perception that the nations have, that the Jews do not have these qualities among them. So I'm just going into that for a second to show that every phrase in these sentences is replete with meaning, and that the whole of Jewish history comes into play here in Isaiah's vision.
Yeah. Wagner made a very big deal of this.
Par exemple.
There was a Jew who committed suicide at the age of 21, who was a vicious anti-Semite, and I think his name is something, I think it's Otto Wittenberg or something along those lines, and he really was the author of ideas that would shape the Aryan notion that the Jew was essentially the feminine, not the masculine. The only true masculine is the Aryan race.
Funnily enough, a lot of Jewish sources would agree with that. In the sense that the Jewish people, especially in the Zohar and other holy texts, are perceived as the feminine counterpart of the divine.
And by the way, Otto, I think his name is Otto Wittenberg, he would ultimately convert to Christianity in order to undo his Jewishness. He couldn't run away from his Jewishness, and ultimately he would lock himself in a hotel room and blow his brains out at the
end. And when they opened the fridge of the hotel room, it was full of gefilte fish.
Yeah, All right.
Achin chaleyenu hu nasana. Here we are going to get to the guts of what excites everybody about this chapter and what it's really, what is really going on.
Hmm.
Here is what the nation's saying now. Okay, we're amazed, we're astonished. Here's this suffering servant, the nation of Israel. Here's this suffering servant that we thought was despised and scorned. Suddenly, we realize that this suffering servant is in fact the true servant of God, and that the major point of this whole revelation comes about through the Jewish people to the world. We're astonished, we're amazed, etc. But then the nations go on to posit this incredible thesis. And please, when we discuss this, please remember, underline this, that we're still inside what the nations are perceiving.
We're in their brains right now.
So they go, oh my gosh, we misread Isaiah 53 the whole time. It's actually about the Jewish people. The Jewish people are the true servant of God. Oh, so why is it that the Jewish people, if they're the servant of God, have suffered so much? How is that? We thought that the whole thing was some sort of Calvinistic triumphalism. If you're doing well, then that means you must be blessed of God because you're winning history.
Right.
How could you be losing history
right. But
be the true servant of God?
Right.
And then it says, oh, say the nations, because in fact the suffering servant was bearing our sins, our horribleness.
Or in a quite literal sense, the Gentiles are saying, you know what, the Jewish people suffered the pain that we deserved.
Exactly.
What really...
Yeah. I haven't got the translation in front of me, so how is that normally translated?
No, I mean, he took our... He carried our sorrows. He bore... And look at the next words. We considered him as though he was stricken by God.
So, anachnu chashavnu, we considered him exactly. Not actually necessarily suffering because of his actions, but in fact, Nagua Mukelu Kimu Umeone, meaning that this was inherent in the suffering servant himself. In other words, he was naturally afflicted by God. He was a creature born to be afflicted.
You know, Christianity, I mean, just in terms of its writers, is such a dichotomy. You mentioned Calvin a moment ago, who probably never met a Jew in his life, given that he lived in countries at the time where no Jew was permitted to reside. But Calvin, although, would speak about the fact that the Jews were such an afflicted nation because they had not only rejected Jesus, but committed the unimaginable act of deicide, killing God. But on the other hand, Calvin was never slow to hold up the Christians who were the Christian martyrs thrown to the lions by Roman emperors who didn't like Christians, and somehow then raising up these Christians who suffered, as he said, for Christ as the great martyrs. Like, somehow to suffer for Christ was a great thing and demonstrated the truth of the cross. But when the Jews suffer, that shows the fallacy of Judaism. They dance, you know, in Yiddish, they dance at two weddings simultaneously.
It does seem that Christianity does contain what could be called a quantum theory of sin.
Yeah.
In other words, because we've got grace, and I don't want to go into this too deeply, because we've got grace, therefore the Jew suffers because he takes the sin that would have come to us. So, chalayenu hun nasai, in other words, they're bearing what really are our travails.
Yeah,
and that, in other words, this sentence, verse 4, is basically a summary of Christian theology, or the theology of anyone who looks at the concept of vicarious suffering.
Hmm. And incidentally, when we come back after news break, the Gentiles, well, no, that's not the song I wanted. I wanted this one. The Gentiles are going to realize that the Jewish people suffered as a result of their own sin.
Oh.
And
Rabbi Singh, you've read this before.
I mean,
you're jumping to the end. You're spoiling the surprise.
That's what the Ukrainians are going to be saying soon. David, we're back. We're discussing Isaiah 53. Let's continue this journey.
Definitely, since we're talking about misconstrued texts. All right. We're up, actually, to verse 5, and there is an astonishing point to emerge from this. You know how many, ever many times people can read Tanakh, read the book of Isaiah, read chapters 52 and 53, and this point may be lost on them, but it is an astonishing point. Let's have a look at verse 5, Tavia. If we may, you might just step in here with the standard translations that you might be familiar with, the listeners might be familiar with. I'll give it a go. V'hu mecholal mipshaeno. So he is mecholal, generally probably means
injured. As the result...
I'm happy with wounded. Mipshaeno, from our...
As a result of our
transgressions, meduka me'avonotenu, oppressed from our sins. This is the thesis of the nations. Remember, if you've just joined us, we once again remind you this is what the nations are saying in chapter 53. This is their idea about what's going on. Musar shlomenu alav. Whoa. Musar meaning sort of corrective treatment, really. Corrective discipline. Musar shlomenu. This is, the commentaries climb all over this about the role of the Jewish people to bring peace to the world. But Musar shlomenu alav, the the discipline which would lead to our welfare is actually upon him, meaning the suffering servant gets it in the neck, but that actually contributes to our well-being because the suffering servant is carrying our sins. This is the thesis of the nations. Would you say that's a reasonable...
Yeah, you know, I was a rabbi years ago. His name escapes me right now. We were learning a sacred text in the Zohar that describes how one of the reasons why the Talmud tells us the reason why the Jews are spread throughout the world in this exile is to be a light to the nations. That we have a very important role in the exile, and that is to be a light to the nations. But when God gives up on a country, when God gives up on a nation, what he does is he actually has the Jews exiled from that nation. What happened to Spain in 1492 is it lost its light. What happened to Portugal in 1496 is it lost its light, meaning the presence of the Jewish people.
And nations that allow Jews back into their country suddenly start doing well on the world stage. And we've seen that time again.
I want to also, incidentally, cross-reference, just if you're writing this down, Psalm 44, where the nation of Israel cries out to God and discusses the pain and the misery of our history. Just write that down. But let's continue in the book.
We're just finishing the verse. Uvachaburato nirpalano, in other words, by his, I don't know, wound, we are healed.
Right.
I want to ask you something, Toby, and I'm just want to go through a series of rhetorical questions with you that, or not so much rhetorical, but a discussion, and I'm leading somewhere with this. If I was to say to you, or anyone, but especially you, when was the book of Isaiah composed? So
you'd say roughly 2700
years. Correct. There are different views. It's either late in the 8th century, or varying chronologies. It could be in the middle of the 6th. Both of those chronologies are contained within the mainstream Jewish world. Even if you take an absolutely apikursisha, higher critical biblical view, when would you say it was written? Let's say you want to say that the prophet Isaiah is writing, you know, he's
a contemporary of Zechariah.
Well, if you like, yeah.
That would be the most...
Post-exilic or whatever.
Whatever.
Yeah, let's even... But we know for a fact that by the time of the Dead Sea Scrolls, by the first century BCE, we've already got the whole book of Isaiah. We know that...
The entire book is there.
Archaeologically, there's no doubt. So, all of this is at least over 2,000 years ago.
Right.
At that time, and I'm saying, go with any of those dates... At that time, was there a general thesis in the world, a theological thesis held by anyone, that nations carry the sins of other nations, or that there is the idea, obviously, you know, like maybe the concept of vicarious suffering, like a scapegoat or whatever, but this idea that there is a relationship between nations where one nation goes through travail in order to provide the welfare of other nations, whether it's spiritual welfare or physical welfare. This is an idea that really comes into the world later on with the advent of Christianity. And yet here is the prophet Isaiah, well before those events, talking about this very concept which lies at the heart of the misinterpretations and exploitations of Isaiah 53 itself.
Yeah.
It's an astonishing point where the prophet is almost saying, forget even what I'm saying, just listen to what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And you'll realize that this chapter was composed with massive divine inspiration.
Yeah.
That this very point will be at the heart of the ultimate salvation of the world, this realization of what Am Yisrael is in the world for all humanity, and a role, by the way, in which all humanity has to play. So it's a tremendous meta idea that's happening throughout this chapter that every time I read it just stuns me. Like I said at the beginning of this chat, you know, it's one of those chapters in the Bible which could actually turn a person from a type of agnostic literary appreciation of the Bible to actually realize just how much it's soaked with divine spirit. The nations then say, and of course, it would be remiss of me, since we have some very learned listeners, it would be remiss, but I don't want to get this in too much detail, but I have had some correspondence on this, it would be remiss of me not to mention that there is a discussion between Rashi and the Radak about the nature of these verses. By all accounts, this thesis is actually wrong. The nations are misconceiving what is going on here. Tovia and I alluded to this before we went to the break. We're still well within what the nations are perceiving, and in fact, we see historically this is precisely what the nations perceive theologically in the major religion of Edom, that the Jewish people are wandering around, they're suffering because they're literally smitten by God.
I think one point that will clear everything up, and that is the most important commentator on Isaiah 53 is the God of Israel. And
yes, that's very cute.
You remember what I did with you, the listener, probably about 15 minutes ago, is I laid it out. I explained that 52:13-15, God is speaking through the prophet Isaiah. 53:1-8, the nations are speaking, absolutely shocked. I mean, literally, they're putting their hands on their mouths, they're stunned, and they're just gushing with sorrow and contrition and trying to make sense out of something that made no sense for thousands of years. I also explained that in Isaiah 53:9-12, the text reverts back to the God of Israel speaking, which means in verse 11, and I know we're getting ahead of ourselves, we are going to discover the precise mechanism that the servant brought healing to the world, that vindicated the just for many. So bear in mind that, when I debated Jan Moskowitz of Jews for Jesus, and I've, done this a lot, and it's on YouTube and so on, I always ask this question, like, what's God's opinion? Everything's at stake here. So what we're going to do is, in a moment, when we get to 53:10, I don't know if it'll be on this show, or 53:11, we will find out from the God of Israel, what is the methodology? How did the servant, Israel, vindicate the just many? Now, bear in mind that from a Christian position, the way the servant, the way that Isaiah 53 is portrayed and misinterpreted, and it's by the blood of the servant, we will see in Isaiah 53:11 that it is by his knowledge, bedato, by his knowledge, my servant will vindicate the just for many, meaning the knowledge of Torah, the role of the Jew is to be a light to the nations, Isaiah 49. These are the very opening words before the Ten Commandments in Exodus chapter 19, 5 and 6. The role of the nation of Israel is to be a mamleches kehanim v'goy kadosh. The role of the Jew is to be literally a chosen people for the purpose of being priests to the world. We will find this out shortly in the 53rd chapter. Right now, we're in the midst of the reaction of the Gentile nations. I want to go, if I can, to 53 verse 7 for a moment, because it's a critical chapter, and I'm going to...
You don't want to do 6 first?
Do we not do 6?
We haven't done 6.
Oh, well, verse 6. Go ahead.
Because I was going to say, you were talking about verse 11 and jumping ahead. We're actually going to find out not only that the nations are wrong, but that, in fact, we're going to find out exactly why the Jewish people go into exile, and it's not for anybody else's sins. And that's going to be uncovered as well in this entire chapter. But verse 6 continues with the thesis of the nations, with this astonishment and with this false perception about... I mean, you've got to understand that by now the revelation of God is almost complete, and the nations realize that they have erred tremendously. So it's like someone coming before the boss and saying, look, this is why we behave this way, because we had this wrong perception about what was going on. Very much like, soldiers who were brought to account before a military tribunal as to why they perpetrated crimes against humanity, and they have to sit around and go, well, we were following orders. Regardless of whether or not that is a good excuse, it's the similar sort of thing. We're really sorry, God, but we had an entirely wrong perception. We thought that the Jewish people existed precisely because they were bearing the sorrows that we inflicted upon them, but in fact that they were sort of in their suffering, we actually gained welfare, and that was their whole purpose in the world.
You know, David, it isn't an accident, and you're a historian. One of the anomalies of Jewish history is that following the advent of a terrible, notable persecution against the Jewish people, I say notable because there wasn't a year in history, certainly over the last 2,000 years, when the Jewish people had not endured unimaginable persecution. But there has been this consistent, very strange anomaly where after the Jews endure persecution, there's this enormous amount of conversion to Judaism. And we've seen that in the first century, which means that the Jewish people suffer miserably. David and I can't possibly, in this show, we've touched upon in other shows, describe to you the misery the Jewish people endured as the first century unfolded, and certainly from the year 63 to 70. There are just no words, except the only thing that will be even the greatest calamity would be the Holocaust itself. And here we are, just seven decades after the Shoah. I mean, just the most unimaginable crime. There is today literally lines around the streets of people, Gentiles, seeking to convert to Judaism. This would be logically the stupidest time to become a Jew. Mm-hmm. If you were a Gentile and had any brains, you'd say, you know what, being a Jew will just get you stuck in an oven. But yet somehow the Jewish people suffer, and it brings a recognition by the Gentiles that maybe we made an awful, horrific, monumental spiritual mistake.
Well, the greatest converts, the truly righteous converts to Israel, have always been recognized as those that joined the fate and destiny of the Jewish people at a time when the Jewish people are down. That is why the rabbis tell us that at the end of days it will be impossible to convert to the Jewish people, because the revelation will be so blindingly obvious that there won't be any choice in the matter. And if there's no choice in the matter, no exercise of free will, then you can't join the destiny of the Jewish people by free will at the end of days. But in saying that, it's very careful. We have to be very careful, you and I, Tovia, that we're not perceived by people that would turn on the radio 30 seconds before hearing it, that the Jewish world and the Jewish people do not encourage other people to join it. A person is perfectly capable of participating in the revelation of God and the destiny of the world by supporting the Jewish people. It's going to be very difficult for non-Jews to participate in their destiny if they're holding concepts and acting in a way that is completely contrary to the will of God in the world. But certainly those who support the Jewish people and seek their welfare have a very great role to play in the unfolding that's going to come. But this verse 6, Kulanu katzon ta'inu, so we all want, this is the nation still speaking, astonished, got this thesis, got this theory about why they've been horrible to the Jewish people. Ah, because we thought that was what was meant to happen. Kulanu katzon ta'inu, we've all wandered around like sheep. Ish ledarko paninu, it's beautifully poetic. Each man, each person to their own way, their own derech turned.
Yeah.
Even within this thesis, in other words, there are many different ideas going on, and everybody went their own way. There was no coherent.
Katzon ta'inu, like sheep, we've not just turned on our own way, but we went astray. We went in the wrong direction.
One needs to be careful. Lit'ot in that context is to wander around like a lost sheep.
Yeah.
The verb to lit'ot, is with a tet.
Yeah.
So it's not quite to yet. What we're doing, what the nations are saying they're doing is like we literally pouring themselves out because they know that they're on the verge of having to justify their behavior throughout history, and like saying, look, we had no one really to guide us and tell us, so we came up with this idea. We were wandering around like lost sheep. Vahashem hifgia bo, and God afflicted him, meaning the suffering servant. The sin of us all.
That means the servant received what they imagine is the punishment that really was due to them.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And that's how the nations saw the world, and that's how many people have seen the world.
Yes. Verse 7.
Yeah. Now we're up to verse 7, and I know you had some significant points to make.
No, it's going to come up. I want to, in a moment...
This is a very, very powerful verse.
And Mayor, just give me a time here, because this is very critical. I want to tie this with a few verses from Zephaniah.
Verses 7 and 8 are very complex verses that we may not be able to complete tonight, because they really rely on the right sort of understanding of the words themselves. Do you have, did you get a time from me?
No, we don't, but let's do this, because I want to do 7 and 8, because that 8 ends where the Gentiles are speaking.
Well, yeah, except I have...
Oh, we have 5 minutes.
Then I don't know if we're going to get beyond 7. I have a few things to say about 8. So if you can wrap up seven, you discuss seven, and then maybe we'll have a crack at eight if there's a couple of minutes.
I want to do this. I wanted to do this with the listeners. I'm going to repeat these verses, Zephaniah chapter 3, verse 12 to 13, where there's a description. It's a messianic chapter. Will Christians agree with that? And it describes the suffering servant. It describes the remnant of Israel, literally. And the description is that I will leave among you a meek and humble people who will trust the name of Hashem. The remnant of Israel will do no wrong. They'll speak no lies. There will be no deceit found in their mouths. They will eat and lie down, and no one will make them afraid. And, of course, you have then single daughter of Zion shout aloud. And you have the single daughter where Isaiah 54 is going to begin with, single barren woman will be dealing with that. But let's go to verse 7 if we can do that.
Nigas v'hu na'aneh. V'lo yiftach piv.
Just same as them.
Yeah, he was...
And people asked the question during the Shoah, how did you just go to the gas chamber without opening your mouth? Why did you remain silent? Why didn't you fight back?
Yeah, afflicted without answering, or oppressed without answering and not opening their mouth. Katzena tevach yuval, like a sheep led to the slaughter. And like a lamb that is made mute before those who shear it, v'lo yiftach piv, and will not open its mouth. In other words, literally led like lamb to the slaughter. That's the origin, in fact, of that phrase.
And incidentally, you'll find that exact phrase describing the Jewish people in Psalm 44.
Yeah. Now, do you want to move on to 8?
Verse 8 has one of the most stunning mistranslations of this.
Absolutely. I am so pleased you said that.
Let's do it.
I need to know if we're talking about the same thing.
Well, we are. Mi pesha ami negalama.
No, we're not talking about the same thing.
Okay.
And we're going to... The massive mistranslation is at the very beginning of the pasuk.
All right. Go ahead.
Me otzer o mi mishpat lukach.
Right.
Everybody climbs over that.
Right.
And they all get it wrong. Everybody thinks that ume otzer is in fact got to do with the root atzar, meaning to be detained,
prisoners,
to be arrested, to be imprisoned. No. The example that we know that what the correct translation of me'otzer mimishpat, this is a big point, Tovia, whether you want to leave it for next week.
No.
Me'otzer mimishpat lukach, Book of Samuel, chapter 9. Can you... hit that. Samuel chapter 9, when God is telling the prophet Samuel that he's going to anoint Saul as king.
Right.
And he says the words, that's the one who I've been talking about, Ze ya'atzor ba'ami, this one will rule my people.
Yes.
That is the exact same route that we're looking at here. Me'otzor me'mishpat lukach does not mean he was taken from imprisonment and trial. It means that the suffering servant, as the nation of Israel, was removed from the whole paradigm and structure of government and justice. This is a remark made. This is the prophet Isaiah is seeing that the Jewish people, and specifically even right up to the time of the Holocaust, are removed from all structures. They have no control over their destiny. They are removed from that, and then, as though to confirm that, v'et doro mi yisocheach, and who said anything in that generation, ki nigzar me'eretz chayim, because he was decreed from the land of life, mi pesha ami negalamo, and now I'll let you translate.
We'll do that next week. Mi pesha ami negalamo.
The Jewish people for thousands of years have been removed from the structures of power.
We'll talk about next week, but the translation is, for the transgressions of my people, they were afflicted, and the word lamo is changed in the King James Bible, him, to the singular. Lamo means them, which means, listen very carefully, they took the word lamo, which means them, referring to the servant in the plural, and just switched it into the singular. How do you play with my Bible, David? Thank you for joining us.
Always good to be here, Tobias.